This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
So we're here at the end of the Trial Lawyers University Conference and been recording all week. Robert's been out here from Law Pods producing all of our shows, flew out here with the equipment. We thank you so much for doing that. It's been great recording live and I just really appreciate it.
No, fellas, I can't tell you what an absolute pleasure it's been to come here and do this for you. We've been working together for a while on your show. We've had some conversations over Zoom, but this is the first time to see you both in person, and it was every bit as good as I hoped it would be. So thanks so much for letting me be involved in your podcast, and this kind of lets me live my dream too. So thanks.
No, you were fantastic, and you know what? Everything is fully professional. You've been amazing to work with, and you do such a great job. So In addition to being a good person, so thank you.
Thanks so much.
And a recovering lawyer.
Yeah, I did my time.
Thanks. Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Okay, we're at the end of the day at the PSBR Trial College, and it must have been a rough day because you're sweating, Ben.
No, I had a rough ping pong match just now. I don't think people realize how physical the game of ping pong can be. Fortunately, I gave Dan Ambrose a good whooping, one he'll hopefully never forget, not challenge me again in ping pong. In my household, we're very serious about ping pong. It's probably one of the only things we're serious about.
And then your son is like a champion ping pong player at Wake Forest?
My son came in second in the college-wide ping pong tournament at Wake Forest. And so I've been threatening since then to get t-shirts made up saying my son is the second best ping pong player in college. We had a good time. Dan actually beat me 21-19. In full disclosure, I'm going to be honest about it. I don't want to be accused of misstating anything.
But you let him win.
I did let him win. Yeah, of course. You don't come to somebody's conference and then beat them in their own game. So I think he's pretty proud of his ping pong skills, and I didn't want to disabuse him of that. Yeah. So you gave a presentation today. I happened to notice standing room only in the room. I mean, I don't know. There was hundreds of people in there. Couldn't even get in. But how did it go?
No, it went great. It's actually, This has been a really awesome conference. And so talking about voir dire and some of the video clips we have from our Vegas trial. So it actually illustrates some of the techniques we use to be effective in having potential jurors actually be honest in sharing their thoughts and beliefs. So I had a great time there. And then
I really want to watch that. And is that going to be available now for streaming? Because I need to watch that one. And I want to watch the Mitnick Panish one from this morning.
Oh, yeah.
That I missed.
Absolutely. Everything's going to be on the TLU Trial Lawyer University website. So become a member of that, and then you can access all of it. And then the other thing totally separate from that is we're actually unveiling the PSBR playbook, where we have professionally done videos kind of in a TED Talk format. And so at psbrplaybook.com, you can access it for free as long as you're a plaintiff lawyer. And so we just kind of want to continue to raise the bar for all trial lawyers. Thought this would be a cool way to do it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I'll definitely check that out.
Yeah. So with us today, we got Justin Kahn. Thank you for joining us, Justin. You just finished a breakout session yourself, right?
I did. I was teaching lawyers how to get up and present.
Present what?
The idea was to get them to start practicing using I use Keynote or PowerPoint presentation to get them on their feet. And the goal is, I love teaching And I think people are afraid of things that they just haven't tried. And so the goal was, part of my talk tells people about how the psychology of attention works. I demonstrate that, and I make them come aware of what the process that goes on in a juror's mind might be, and how they have to be aware of that as a lawyer, how to control and keep that attention. And so I give them some examples, and we've met on Zoom a couple of times. And so I basically have slides done for them, about 10 or 12, which will walk through basically a intersection collision case or sidewalk crosswalk case. And the slides are done. And then they're encouraged to use the PowerPoint slides themselves. I have a blow up done of a fracture to the spine. And then we have a flip chart. And they're encouraged to use these different tools and to see which ones they can use in a quick 10-minute sort of opening to get them up on their feet and recognize their different tools available to them, including no technology at all, just pressing the button to make the screen go blank, and to feel, which a lot of lawyers don't do, the power of when the jury is not looking at the screen, they then look at you, and then you could then interact with them and how that can make you a more effective communicator. And they start to realize that these tools are available to them, and it gives them a chance to play with it and try it out and go back and do better.
It's awesome. And you spend a lot of time studying communication and intentional and subconscious communication. I get a lot of emails from you with all sorts of articles, things that are Apple's presenting things. And it really, half of the stuff comes out of non-trial lawyer type of information, which makes total sense. But how much time do you actually spend studying this?
Well, I love to open up. I have sort of three categories of books that I like to have: neuroscience, neuropsychology kinds of books, graphic design kinds of books, and persuasion communication kinds of books. And what happens is, as a lawyer, you're looking at case law a lot, but your job is to figure out how to communicate to the jury, and sometimes to the judge, because I use the same sort of techniques or ideas with a judge for motion practice. But how can I use things that have nothing to do with what I'll call law and use these tools available to you as a lawyer to communicate effectively? And so I spend time getting in these different books and reading about neuropsychology and neuroscience. There are podcasts on it. When I exercise, I'll listen to them. And you pick up these tools or these ideas that are well known about how the mind works. And as an attorney, you have to know how somebody's mind and how the attention works in order to communicate with that mind, that juror, that judge. And knowing how that works allows you to be more effective at what I call basically teaching it. That's the goal, is you're an attorney, you're a teacher. So what are the tools available to you as a teacher that are well recognized? And so one of the people from here out in California, Professor Richard Meyer, who talks about multimedia learning. Literally, before I came here, I bought the latest third edition of Cambridge book. It's got a whole slew of articles about how students best learn. I try to read that and apply that to the practice of law. I don't know if I answered your question.
For folks who haven't kind of read any of that literature and don't know much about the neuroscience or the science of persuasion in that manner, can you give us kind of a primer on what some of the key points are that we should be thinking about?
Well, to me, the big picture is that as a lawyer, you can't assume just because you start talking about something or you start showing the jury something that they're going to get it. There's a lot of things that are going on in the mind and the way it processes information and images that you need to be aware of. You can't just assume because you show the jury a particular picture or a particular scene that they're going to immediately understand it. You start learning things about how the mind actually processes information. So, for example, actually back in early 1900s, a Russian filmmaker named Kuleshov demonstrated this, where he shot, I'll call it a video of, one video, I guess it was actually film, of somebody's face, an actor's face, looking towards the camera. And he followed that with a clip of a bowl of soup. And he asked people, what is this person thinking? And they all said, well, he looks hungry. Then he showed them a picture of the same actor's face with a picture of a little girl in a coffin And they said, well, what are you thinking that he's thinking? And the answer was, well, he looks very sad. He's thinking about the death of his little girl. And there was another one of the sort of sexy woman laying on a couch, sexy in the early 1900s sense. And what are you thinking? And they said, well, he's thinking lustful thoughts. And what was going on was each of the images was, it was the same video or same film of the actor's face followed by a different image. And what you learn is that it's called the Kuleshov effect. And so the, what that shows us is that the order in which you present information can affect how the perceiver of that image thinks what's going on. And just by changing, and Kahneman talks about this in his books about thinking fast and slow, that the order in which you present information can affect how somebody perceives it. So as a lawyer, how could you not know that the order in which you unpack this, these facts can matter? And so to me, that's one of the important things that, one of the important reasons why I believe it's necessary to read some of these materials to sort of understand how the mind works. You can't just assume if you lay out certain facts in a temporal fashion, it's going to be effective. You have to understand how the mind processes information in order to be more effective.
So for example, all that you just said, apply it to a legal setting.
Well, sure. Like we just talked about, the Kuleshov effect. It may be that telling the story, you're going back to David Ball's idea about talking about the accountant who decides to get off. He always works till 5 o'clock and decides on this one particular day that he's going to get off work early and decides that, what the hell, I'm just going to go meet my family. We're going to the beach. Let's go there. And he drives along the particular path and he says, you know what? I normally take the interstate home. This time I want to take the country road because I haven't done that before. Why not? And then I'm going to stop off for the piece of pie at the restaurant. And then he eats the piece of pie and says, what the hell, one more. And then he ends up getting in a wreck. And all the jurors, when he asks what happened, it's like, well, as I'm assuming people know, so let me continue it. So he ends up leaving the restaurant. He gets to a red light, and it's green. It goes to yellow, and he decides, I'm in no rush. I'll stop. And he does stop. The light turns green, and he gives it the gas, and a truck comes and hits him from the side. They think that's the right way to tell the story, but it turns out, because all the spotlight has been on the plaintiff, jurors would tend to blame the plaintiff, because only if he didn't take the different route, only if he didn't stop it.
That's where my mind went.
I was thinking the second piece of pie is what really got him there.
Oh, y'all haven't heard that before?
No.
Oh, well, that's the example of... I'm sorry, I assumed y'all knew about that. So that's what happens is when you tell the story and what you as the lawyer think, well, this is the temporal sequence, everything will be fine. And it turns out what happens, the psychology behind it is you're so focused on the plaintiff's conduct that you blame the plaintiff versus telling the story this way. It's 6 a.m. We see a man getting into an 18-wheeler. He's got a beer can in his hand. He's driving an Exxon truck.
I already know what's going to happen. It's not good.
But the other guy stopped for the second piece of pie.
But
the,
you know, you wouldn't tell that story. You wouldn't tell. But, right, but that's the idea about the sequencing.
Yeah.
Can affect not just what you perceive happened, but how you assign as the listener or hearer the blame, because you've been provided more facts about... I didn't know y'all hadn't heard that before.
No,
that's nice.
It's interesting because I've never heard that particular example. I totally get the concept, though, and I think that's what... I try to employ, but it's so interesting. So are you seeing people kind of going in a linear fashion like that from the wrong spotlight and focusing on the wrong things?
Well, that's what I think happens is as lawyers, you think a particular way. You think, quote, air quote, logically, and you think the temporal timeline is the best way to tell the story when it may not be. And that goes back to the Kuleshov effect. And the same set of facts told in a different sequence can end up with a different meaning. And you as a lawyer have to know that and be aware of that and to think through that. That is, simply telling the story temporally may not be the best thing for your client.
Do you have a view based on that of there's sort of a debate now in openings as to whether some people like to start with the bad thing that happened at the end? So one example is you start with the horrible wreck. The smoke, you know, a picture of the smoke coming up out of the car, or somebody lying on the side of the road, or I think about the famous Mark Lanier PowerPoint from the Vioxx trial, where he started with the photo of the decedent who was slowly disappearing, and so you're getting people's minds focused on something really terrible happened here, and then you're kind of going back and thinking about why did it happen, versus sort of the what you were describing, the ball approach, where you start earlier in time with the conduct of the defendant and lead up to the bad thing.
Right. That is what I'm suggesting is you have to, as a lawyer, know that how you tell the story can have an impact. The best way, again, in air quotes, you may have to focus group. It may be something that you can't just assume because you start off with something that's interesting, it's going to be the best sequence. To me, I always think about Hollywood videos and the famous one with Spielberg and Saving Private Ryan. Do you remember where it started?
Probably on the battlefield. That's
what everybody thinks, but it actually did not. It started with the man bringing his family to the cemetery. And it ended with, was it worth it, you know, for y'all to, you know, for all these people who have died for me? And so you have to think like Spielberg, like a movie director. How are you going to tell this story? And, you know, as a movie director, which is in some, and that's one I was talking about in my Get Up and Present seminar, if you think about closing as a storyboard, first of all, if you know that, I like Bob Marley in the background. if you think about your role as a trial lawyer as being basically a film director, how are you going to tell the story? And Hollywood does that via something called storyboards. So whether it's a Pixar animated story or Star Wars, there's a series of, they've got a script, but before they go out and shoot, they don't just show up somewhere and say, well, why don't you stand over there and let's start taking the picture. They actually have the series of the equivalent of like 3x5 cards with an artist that's drawn them out, and they lay out the sequence of the shots, the camera angles, to tell the story. And like one of the things Pixar does is that there's a room that they have, and I assume Panache, Boyle, and Rabaputi has a room like this, where people can go into a room and nobody will be criticized for attacking a partner about their story. But they will lay out the series, the images of the story, and people go into this room and they listen to the person present the story, and then they say, you know, that's not the best way to say it. You know, move that card that's at 52nd spot to number 2, or whatever it might be. And so you as a lawyer need to think about that, and you translate that to a keynote or PowerPoint presentation. And so you've got these series of slides, and you have an opportunity, like a movie director, to then tell the story in these series of slides. And so that's, so going back to your question about how might you do that, if you think about your keynote or PowerPoint slides as basically a storyboard, and it's your opportunity to tell the story for your client, think to yourself when you're first meeting the client, what is the story I'm going to tell in closing? What are the images that I want to present? And then part of, if you're, one way to think about it is, if you're going to be doing it that way, and you want to tell the story a particular way in closing, then your job is, as part of the discovery process, is to go out and get those images, to find them and drop them into the storyboard. And that's your job as part of the discovery process, if that makes a kind of sense or not. I'm using my hands here, but there's no camera. But
you know, it's interesting because probably the Bob Marley music is helping to illustrate your point, because people at home probably have an image of what we're doing right now that may seem very different from us sitting on a couch, you know, in a suit, having a conversation. But without the Bob Marley music, they'd have a very different view of what we're doing right now.
It's fascinating you say that, because one of the things I've thought about is, think about how often you go to a movie, and as part of the unfolding of the video, of the movies, the images, and the words, there's music in the background which is setting the mood. And can we as trial lawyers do that or not? I mean, you know, is there a way to because it can affect so much of the mood. I mean, so much of you sitting through a movie, you know, the dun-dun-dun, whatever it might be, can set the stage, and the bad, you know, don't go in there, what are you doing, just by the music. And so as you say that, I'm thinking about, you know, how could, you know, this question, why not push the envelope? One of the things I like talking about as trial lawyers is, how can we push the envelope? That's one of the things I like to do. I don't like to be told this is the way the law is. You're stuck with it. I like to be told with, that was what the last judge did. That's what the last lawyer argued. I'm going to argue something different. And here's why I think it's right. And how can I push the ball forward for justice for my clients? So that's what I like to try to do.
So let me ask you on that, though, and talking about the concept of analogies between movies, right? And so when you're analogizing it with the horror films and everything else, isn't that, do you think there's a point at which theater should be put to the side and the jury should be left with the truth, the concepts of harms and losses when they're evaluating what the damages are? Like, does a horror film background somehow cause a jury to want to award more or less money, I guess is my question. I'm skeptical on it. I don't know if you can tell by my posing of the question.
The answer is, I think it depends on the case, and that's the truth. And one of the things that I've been learning through Trial Lawyer University and the opportunity to meet all kinds of different lawyers, including y'all, and people like Sean Claggett and John Campbell, is that there are tools available to lawyers to test things out. And it's not what your gut says, it's what a group of people say, and that's what matters. And so when you mention that, to me, the first thing that occurs to me is, I don't know, let's try it out on a focus group and see what they think. You know, I think Phil Miller, who's one of the lawyers here, who's I've been learning from forever, people may be familiar with Miller's Mousetrap, and he now does a bunch of consulting. He talks about that the survey companies spend like $80-something billion a year on surveys because they want to know what people think about things. They don't want to just start marketing a product without knowing what they think. And we as trial lawyers, not in an evil way, but need to understand what the jurors want to, what they need to understand. I think that sort of goes back to your horror film analogy, is that maybe it's the right thing to do. It may not be. And again, that goes back to the Kuleshov effect. It's like the order creates meaning. You know, there's a famous, in Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, they give an example of people are asked about the characteristics of two particular people, and they provide them with a series of words that describe them. And they're asked, which one do you like more, or which one's more loving, or whatever it might be? And people answer invariably one particular person, Sue, or versus the guy. But the exact same words are provided to the people about both of them in a different order. And so again, that order creates meaning to me is an important concept. So going back to your horror store analogy, it may or may not be right. And it's one of the things I think you have to explore as a lawyer. I guess what you're sort of hearing from me is going back to one of the questions you asked earlier about how much time do I spend studying things other than law. I love trying to push law and understanding it, but I think as an attorney, you have to know about human decision making and how people think about things and how the mind processes information, which is different than merely knowing what the law is. I don't know if I answered that. That was a long way to try to wrap things together.
Can we go back to your breakout group? So you were working with people, they had different exhibits, and you were helping them develop the techniques for how to best work with those exhibits and present them. Can you give us some tips on what's the best practices for using blow-ups and PowerPoints and everything as you're presenting them, in your view? Well,
sure. One of the things that, number one is, I think you have to become comfortable with technology. You have to know that when you push the button, the next slide is going to come up. You have to know that, and you have to feel it in your gut. When I press this button, it's going to work. But at the same time, you have to know if it's not going to work, what are you going to do? Y'all saw me doing some magic tricks earlier. I talked about what lawyers can learn from magicians, and one of the things magicians know is they have to have what's called an out. That not if, but when a trick goes bad or wrong, doesn't work as expected, something doesn't happen. Instead of the magician reacting to that and going, oh crap, let me start over, if they just keep going forward, even if it's in a different direction, the participant doesn't know that if the magician doesn't react. And so you as a lawyer have to be and have the same mindset that if you're in the middle of a trial and the screen goes blank and you know it should not, instead of freaking out and turning and glaring to somebody, walk somewhere, pick up a blow up, and start talking about whatever it is that you need to talk about. Go write something on a flip chart and then let people fix whatever the problem is. In fact, that's one of the things we try to practice in our office from time to time, and depending on the group I'm working with, is I will pull out the plug in the middle of somebody's presentation. They then have to just move forward. And I'll have a blow up. That's one of the things I did in this presentation is I have a series of slides already prepared that walk through a collision sequence. I have an MRI of a fractured spine, and then I have a flip chart. And the goal is to encourage people as they are presenting is not simply to be locked in on using the presentation, but to be able to press a certain button and have the screen go blank. And what you will learn as a lawyer is this, and I don't know if y'all have tried this in the middle of trial, try making the screen go blank, and you will see something magical happen. All of the jurors' eyes turn from that screen to you. And you have to give that a moment to sink in, and then you can make eye contact with them, and you have an opportunity to persuade. One of the things that I talk about in these seminars that I talk about how to present better is Richard Meyer and some of the people like that talk about this idea of cognitive load. That learning decreases as cognitive load increases. And if you're going to be presenting information to people, you need to be doing it in bite-sized morsels, because if you increase the work that the brain has to do on the participant or hearer or person you're trying to teach, their ability to take it in goes down, the frustration goes up, and your ability to persuade goes down. So what can you do as the presenter ahead of time to decrease that cognitive load? And there's certain techniques or ideas that are recognized that allow people to decrease the cognitive load. There's a couple of examples. There's something called the segmenting principle. If you're going to be presenting a complex idea, which oftentimes in trials we're doing, especially in complex cases, if you simply put up a slide that shows whatever the complexity thing is, I'll use a simple example that I use all the time, how a computer network works. If you put up a slide that shows the internet with all the routers and all the devices attached and say, this case is simple, we're going to talk about how a network works, most people would shut down right away if you put that image up. If you use the segmenting principle, what you do is you break down the introduction of those images or that idea into bite-sized pieces until you have the whole image. So for example, you might start off by showing just a picture of a cloud and a wire hanging down. Say, we're going to be talking about how a network works. That's what this case is about. Everybody's familiar with the concept of the internet. And so the internet's, people think of it as the cloud, and there's a wire that comes into your office. The next image, it shows a firewall attached to that line. Said, there's this thing called a firewall, and that the job of that firewall is to keep bad things from coming into your office and good things from going out of the office. And then there's a line, the next slide would have a line attached to the firewall that's attached to the router. Say, the router is a device that's used to then distribute that information among all the various devices that might be in your office. And then from there you might have lines that go down and show the various devices that are attached. And because the information has been presented in bite-sized pieces, people can now understand it, as opposed to putting up the slide, which is the end slide first, and say, let's talk about this. People's minds may shut down and say, there's no way I can get this. So that's an example of the segmenting principle. Another one is the coherence principle. And the idea about that I think is a big deal is that the use, and oftentimes you see lawyers put up a whole bunch of words on slides, and people have a difficult time when you are providing the equivalent of verbal voiceover for a slide that has a bunch of words on it. They don't know is not the right word. It's difficult for them to process, am I supposed to be paying attention to the person who's speaking and the words they're saying, or am I supposed to be looking at the words on the screen? Which one's more important? And as they're subconsciously making that decision, what you are saying may be lost on them, not through any fault of their own, but just because they can't process it. So I talk about these two modes of presentation, verbal and visual, and that you have to, as the lawyer, be aware of it. And basically your job is to be more like Steve Jobs, and you present an image and do a verbal voiceover to tell a story, as opposed to someone like Bill Gates, and you're just standing in front of a screen with a whole bunch of colors and words behind you and talking. So I can't remember what the question was. But that's part of my, I'll call it philosophy or ideas about how, some of the things I teach in these seminars is to get people to start thinking about things like that. And it's nice because you start seeing participants, and I'm pointing to the room behind me, where they then now see that happening. When they get up and start presenting, they see when they make the screen go blank, the eyes come towards them and they understand, oh, this is powerful. This is a technique I can use. If I write something on the board, the eyes go there. This is an opportunity for me to explain something differently. And so part of these seminars or techniques that y'all put on allows these participants to come in and try these different things out and see for themselves in action how these different ideas work. So I like to, typically when I speak, I like to talk about not just, it's frustrating for me to go to seminars where people talk about theory. And you're like, oh, that's great. Tell me how it works. Or let me show me an application. So I like to try to talk about a theory, demonstrate it, and then show how you can then use that in a case. And Rahul does a great job of that all the time. He talks about theory, and then he tries to show specific examples, whether it's through CVN or some other idea, about how you then go to apply it. And to me, I like to think of myself as a teacher. And I know Rahul feels, I believe Rahul feels the same way. I assume you do too. And one of the cool things about being a teacher is it's not just about imparting knowledge. It's, as a teacher, when I'm sitting in that room, I'm watching others and I'm learning. I'm learning from them. And nobody believes that. But good teachers will pick up on students that they're teaching ideas that they can use. So to me, that's a powerful, I won't call it a trick, but a powerful, the sincere desire to teach and to break it down into itty-bitty pieces, I think is what a lawyer should be doing. And I think lawyers should always, we've talked about that, I think Brian was talking about that this morning. If there's anybody, if anybody needs anything ever, let us know, we'll send it to you. Why? Because sharing the knowledge is a better way to keep the fire burning. If you keep it to yourself, because of your own selfishness, it doesn't help anybody. The law becomes worse, you can't improve on it, and nobody benefits. When everybody shares their information and knowledge, the law becomes better, our clients are better served, and we can continue to progress and push the boundaries of where the law should be.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com.
So let me ask you a question, because, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, but when you have a bunch of words on a PowerPoint slide, what do you think the motivation is of the lawyer who does that? Is it using the PowerPoint slides as a crutch, or is it sort of this dual infusion of information where they want somebody to read a bunch of things while they're hearing different things?
I have two thoughts about that. One is, I think that some lawyers aren't doing it out of laziness. They just see other lawyers do it and they perceive that's the way to do it. And so they don't know better. So that's what I'll call one category. Another category might be what you have talked about, which is a lawyer puts the slides up with a bunch of words so they don't have to walk around with notes. And I think that those lawyers are doing themselves a disservice, because when they do that, the segmenting of the coherence principle kicks in. You increase cognitive load and the audience can't take in the information as well. So what ought to be happening is, and that's one of the reasons why I do this class, is that you spend the time picking the images that help tell your story, and you're basically providing a verbal voiceover, and you don't need notes. Because you, the other thing that is incredible that sort of ties in with magic is you have to practice like you are going to perform it. And to spend the time getting up after not just making the series of slides, but to actually get up, say out loud what it is you're going to be doing as you're going through the slides makes you better at it, and certain things kick in. Number one, sort of muscle memory kicks in, so you're able to do that without notes. But the other thing that happens is if you're receptive to it, you realize that as you're speaking, the particular slide you're showing doesn't fit in with where you are, or it doesn't line up, or it's not connected properly with what you've just shown. And you can then move slides around or change them. So I think you need to start practicing like you're going to perform. And lawyers miss out on that opportunity, or think they think it's not that important. I'll just make the slideshow the night before. And they miss out on the opportunity to practice. Going back to your question about the use of words, they can then start pulling away the words from the screen because they know what it is they're going to say, and they don't need the crutch of the words, and they gain the credibility of the jury because you as the lawyer are teaching with the verbal voiceover with the images, which is the better way to go.
Where do you come down on the question of the? I heard a debate once between two really smart lawyers. One uses very sophisticated visual presentations for openings and throughout trial. The other lawyer, who is a little bit more old school, said, you know, this is a really great presentation and it's really effective, but by over-visualizing it, you're disrupting your intimate connection with the jury.
I know the debate you're talking about, by the way.
But I always thought that was really fascinating. And so one thing I've toyed with, in fact, I demonstrated in my group this morning, is for the first 5 minutes of my opening, I won't use any visuals because I want to look each juror in the eye. I want to develop a personal and intimate connection, hopefully carrying over from voir dire if I have it. And I really just want to talk to them. And I get that people learn better from having multimedia and visuals, but ultimately trials are not academic exercises in teaching. We're not trying to make people learn things. We're trying to persuade them. And that's not always exactly the same thing. It can be, because if you don't have the information, you might not be persuaded. But there is a difference. And one thing that got me thinking about it is, if you go back and read some of the kind of old-time lawyers, the real, like, you know, people that were masters of language, there's something really beautiful about, like, and it seems stilted by modern language, but you can see the power of it. And I just kind of wonder where you come. I mean, I like visuals. I use a lot, but I'm always trying to balance that. What's the right balance between having visuals, but disrupting your connection with the jury too?
And we've asked a couple different things, and one of the things I think about is, I like reading. To me, some of the oldest. I like reading old case law. If I can cite a case, and I'm from South Carolina, and we have case law on punitive damages going back to like literally like 1796 or something. It's like one of the first cases, like the third case in the South Carolina court reports deals with a punitive damage case where a doctor basically spiked somebody's beer and made him real sick, and punitive damages were appropriate. So I like reading old case law, and I'm with you. I like that. I won't call it flowery language, but that sort of deep thought, philosophical kinds of language. I like that. But who are we talking to? The jury is a group of people, for the most part, who are used to looking at information on, I'm holding up an iPhone that's, you know, 3x5 or less, and getting, I mean, look, when you swipe up to the news, you tap on news, you get an image with words. And you're looking at the image saying, I don't want to read that story. You're not looking at the words. I mean, the words might sort of suck you into it, but you pull up, the image is a part of that. And so I don't disagree. And when you're reading those cases, what I think is happening is you have an opportunity to combine the best of both worlds. You now have the opportunity to combine an image with potentially, I won't call it necessarily the flowery language, but sort of the language like Mo Levine or whatever it might be. You have an opportunity to do that, but with an image. And that, to me, can convey a more powerful effect on your audience. And it's interesting you talk about the difference between persuasion and education. I'm with you. You know, I took communication classes in college, and I'll never forget one of the film classes I had was they were talking about what's the difference between propaganda and a documentary. I mean, so you end up with these philosophical, you know, what is the difference? It's always the intent. Well, what does that mean? You know, and so the only reason I'm sort of raising that is you can always debate what's the best. I come back on the idea of if we as lawyers are teachers, which I think is what we are teaching complex things or teachers who may not be familiar with the ideas, what are well-recognized methodologies available to teachers? What are the tools available to them that we as lawyers can adopt? And by using those tools, like Keith Bentley was talking about, and Brian Panish, you gain credibility. And so if you can teach well, I think it gains credibility. So I'll sort of quibble with you about the idea about the difference between persuasion and teaching. I agree there's a difference theoretically. But as a lawyer, in order to persuade, I think you have to teach well. So it's the chicken and egg. Which comes first?
That makes sense.
Yeah. It's that concept of actually empowering the jury and through teaching them. But you know what resonated with me was the intent. And so I think that goes back to the concept of, you know, what's our intent as we go out there. And it's different for every lawyer as to how you want to go about it. But I kind of share some of your philosophies, Justin, that I want to try and teach and empower the jury to reach, hopefully, the right conclusion. And I guess that gets into the semantics of persuasion.
Well, one of the things, again, I can't remember if we talked about magic or if I had just done it beforehand, but one of the things that a magician does that I think a lawyer, and not in a tricky sense, but as a magician, has to be aware of, what is the audience's perception of what they are doing? You, when you are performing, whether you're a lawyer or a magician, you have to recognize what is the idea that is being created. What is your goal in creating what particular idea in the jury's mind, the participant's mind? And you have to have that awareness when you are performing. So as a magician, for example, you have to watch your angles. Because if you don't watch your angles, the audience may see something they shouldn't, and then there's no effect. As a lawyer, you need to watch your angles. You need to make sure when you're presenting something, the jury, every member of the jury can see it. And so like when we were in my class earlier, people became aware of when they were standing up presenting something, if they were blocking the screen, they need to be aware of that's not good because now you're affecting the ability of the jury to take in the information and to persuade them. So I think constantly going back to even Kuleshov, how the unpacking of the information in a particular order is creating certain ideas in jurors' minds. And to the extent that you as a lawyer just happen to be someone who's there saying, this is sort of what the facts are, I'm not that great at this stuff, and you create in the juror's mind, this is what happened, it's not because the lawyer told me that's what happened, but they've built the story up in their own mind, that can be persuasive without you taking credit for it, if that makes a kind of sense. And so you have to have humility, humbleness, to recognize that your job is not to make the case about you, but to impact and create the ideas in the jurors' minds and think about how you can most effectively do that. So I don't know if that answers, I can't remember if that was what you were asking or not, but that, I wrote down as you were talking the idea about, yeah, your goal is to create ideas in the jurors' minds, which they think are their own ideas. And to the extent that you're not pushing them into the idea, but rather they think it's their own idea, you're even more persuasive because not it's not about you, it's about what they all know. Does that
make
sense?
So you've referenced magic a bunch of times, and I just want our listeners to know that you are a very talented magician. You've been going around doing card tricks, which are pretty astounding. How did you learn magic? Has it been kind of a lifelong interest for you?
I started off in, I think my mother got me the Mickey Mouse Book of Magic when I was a kid. She didn't make me run 13 miles. She got the Mickey Mouse Book of Magic, and I sort of read it and sort of got into it. And over time, I got in and out of magic. And in college, I got into it, and it was an interesting way to meet people. And then as I've progressed, when you practice law, it can become all-consuming if you like it. I mean, even if you don't like it, it can become all-consuming. And so to me, an out or a way to not think about law, one of the ways is I like reading about magic and practicing magic. Because to me, a magician does what a lawyer is doing is interacting with an audience. And so it gives me an opportunity to interact with people. I can walk up to people and practice what works to make somebody comfortable. If I'm doing something and they react in a way that I thought was wrong, then I know as a lawyer, okay, I don't need to be doing that. I need to keep a certain distance. And going back to the example I was talking about, like watching your angles, when you become aware of the ability of a magician to create, to do something which creates an effect in the participant's mind, that's the same thing that a lawyer should be doing that is being very persuasive. It's not about the lawyer. And there's a famous magician, I think it was Darwin Ortiz. I like reading about magic philosophy or magic theory, if that's a thing. And one of the things I read is, as a magician, you need to decide when you're going out to do a trick, what kind of magician do I want to be? Do I want this trick to be about me? Look, everybody, look what I can do. You can't do it, ha, ha, ha. Or do I want to be about, watch this. I don't know how this works, but let's experience this together. And to create the feeling in others. And I think that's what, Rahul, you've seen. To me, that's what's fun, is the reaction that other people, the joy that people have, the genuine joy, childlike joy that people have when I do a magic trick is so much fun to me. And that's what I like. And that, to create that that feeling in people, is that's fun. I mean, that's what it's about. I mean, I do the same thing over and over, but not quite, because there are different people involved. And I have to be aware of who's around me and who I'm going to interact with. That may choose who I speak to. South Carolina doesn't have the board hire that y'all have, but knowing which person I need to walk up to first and interacting with that person can affect the rest of the audience. And knowing that as a magician, I assume that, you know, you do the Vordire here and elsewhere. Knowing who to pick may have an impact on how other people then contribute to the process. So again, that's another analogy I'll use with magic.
Yeah, no, I like watching the same trick over and over again. But you were talking about, so you actually are going to share all your magic tricks with me and teach me how to do them all, right?
I'm doing it right now on video so everybody can see this is how you do this. I will. I mean, to me, what's fun about it is I will share with you if you promise to practice it and try them out on people. I will. Because to me, it's a way to connect with people that lawyers don't typically do. It's an opportunity. As lawyer, what do you... How many lawyers walk up to somebody in a social setting and what are you going to talk about? You want to talk about some case you've got? They don't want to hear that. But if you walk up and say, hey, look, I've got, or if you start playing around with cards, people will ask you, what's that? It's like, oh, well, let me show you something. And then they're sucked into it and it's a lot of fun. And then you start playing with their emotions and how, as a lawyer, that's part of what you're doing is, I won't say playing, but you're aware of how you can impact and affect emotion in certain ways. And to me, this is just an opportunity to practice that and plus have fun. And
well, your magic is very impressive. It's not just casual, you know, parlor tricks. You really know what you're doing.
Can I say one thing as we're wrapping this up is, over the last almost 3 years, we've been sort of in lockdown and then had all these Zoom meetings with a bunch of lawyers. Dan was leading a lot of these. And I'd say one of the greatest benefits of this whole experience, which has not been the greatest being in a pandemic, was getting to meet you, Justin, and learning a lot about you. And I don't think we would have ever had the chance to meet but for that. It's really, you're an intriguing person. And so I really appreciate, and I mean that in the most positive way. It could be read two different ways. I meant it in the positive way. So thank you.
I really appreciate that because the feeling is mutual. You have shown us, it's neat to meet somebody who has a similar interest that you've never met and would never have met before that enjoys doing the same things. I mean, you have zero problem getting up and sharing a difficult case and how you went about preparing it in order to help your client and to help others do that. I mean, that is cool as crap. I mean, I would never have met you. And even though it's only via Zoom, I felt like I got to know you. I mean, Ben, not so much. I don't know who he is. No, but even through, so it's, I genuinely appreciate that because to me, that is one of the cool things via Zoom. You have this connection with people that you wouldn't otherwise have. And one of the things that I think we as trial lawyers, at least on the certainly on the plaintiff side, have to do is to share with each other. That is such an important goal, and always push it. I feel like all the time that the law is against our clients. And instead of simply accepting that the law is what it is, you as a trial lawyer have to say to yourself, what could the law be? What should the law be? And how can I go about affecting that change? And going back to what Ben was saying earlier, reading the old stuff, think about what Mel Belli and lawyers before him were dealing with. Contributory negligence? I mean, they may or may not have had voir dire. I mean, they were pushing the envelope. And I think our job as lawyers is to continue that push and not whine about where we are, but think affirmatively, what can we do to carry that ball forward for the next generation of lawyers? And one of the best ways to do that is to share information and ideas, not keep them to ourselves and think to ourselves, well, if I keep this, I'll be more successful. Because sharing the information helps not only you, but your clients and other lawyers. And something else that I truly believe is that, and I got this from Harry Filo, a lawyer in Detroit, and Linda Miller Atkinson, is that when you have an idea, not only do you share it, write articles about it. I think the other side of the bar does a very good job of getting articles out there, which, because they're out there, gain have some sort of credibility. And I think we as trial lawyers need to write just as effective kinds of articles, force ourselves. It's a pain. You got to write an article. You got to take the time to do it. But the ability to then create an article which somebody else can then use in their case and other people, and it gets cited in the case law and it helps everyone build, I think is an incredibly important idea and concept that I vigorously try to do all the time. I try to write at least 2 or 3 articles a year. I really do try to keep pushing the envelope and pushing the ball forward. So I appreciate your comment. Because I have equal admiration for you, and I'm sorry about the jokes I made about the pole in your dog. Hang
out. It's a fire pole.
I won't say what it is. What I said, because I don't know what your wife to get mad about it. But it may be an exercise pole. I don't know.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for doing the podcast. You were a fantastic guest. I learned so much, and it's really nice to meet you.
Great meeting y'all.
Absolutely. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.